KBOO Portland.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Trippy Politics, Protests, and
Potpourri.
I'm your host, Corelia, and my co-host,
Leslie McLam.
And very special episode today, one I've been excited for a while. We have a very special guest in today. I'll let you introduce yourself.
Hi, I'm Ryan Haas. I'm an editor at OPB.
Nice to have you here. Me and you have actually been like talking mostly over the summer on like Twitter and whatnot, and then like finally got to meet a couple months back when you were doing the Bundyville
live event. Yeah. Right.
And I was really excited because when I saw that, I was like, oh my God, I actually get to finally meet Ryan. So you right now have been working with OPB for how long?
I've been there since 2013, so about 6-7 years, something
okay.
like that.
And yeah, I've been kind of following a lot of your reporting. I know you do like a lot of coverage on different subjects here in town, mm-hmm. like the protests and stuff like that.
Correct.
One of the main ones I wanted to talk to you about right now is actually one of the main reasons I came here to KBOO and started my podcast here with my awesome co-host was my cousin's situation out in Clackamas yeah. County.
I had interviewed him after the situation occurred with his cousin, who was found at the county jail.
Yeah, deceased. Right. Clark County, right?
Yeah.
Clark County mm-hmm. jail,
he was
correct.
Found in Clark County jail. He was deceased on a Sunday morning. And yeah, the whole situation when it came out, it was just really frustrating for the whole family. There's very little information. And we still don't feel it's resolved, mm-hmm. right? And
didn't you put in a request for some information at that time?
Yeah, I put in several information requests. I mean, you both have probably experienced with that. But yeah, it took forever, months, for me to even get like a response from them. And when I did, it was not even marked what the information I had requested for was. I mean, I know you yourself, mm-hmm. Ryan, have done like a lot with Multnomah County. What have you been doing there?
Yeah, actually, so last year we at OPB, myself and a couple of reporters here and one reporter in Olympia, Washington, undertook this project that we wanted to figure out how many people were dying in county jails in Oregon and Washington. And so we filed many, many public records requests and tracked media reports and tried to figure out this total number over the past decade of how many people have died in jail and what were the kind of causes of why people were dying in jail. And what we found from our reporting was, you know, over the past 10 years, more than 300 people have died in county jails in Oregon and Washington. You know, a lot of those are by suicide, more than half were by suicide. And then there's things like, you know, drug withdrawal is a big problem. Just general health issues, people with mental health issues who need assistance and aren't getting it. And so what we found through our reporting was there's just a big lack of healthcare in jails. And there's, you know, as the mental health care system in both states has sort of been unable to keep up with the need, a lot of those folks, rather than getting help, are being pushed into jails, whether that means, like I said, you know, you need mental health treatment or you need drug treatment or something. You know, you don't need to be in a jail setting. You need assistance. And when they go into a jail setting, then suddenly you have people who are running these jails. Often the county sheriff's office is running the jail, and they just don't have the training to deal yeah. with those situations, and it's really dangerous. And so
are there any laws that mandate them to have a certain amount of medical staff or a certain level of medical knowledge in the facility?
It's really interesting. No. You know, there's no standard of, like, here's how we operate. Oregon has some standards. Washington does not have any set standards.
Are the standards changing by county?
Right. Okay. Yeah, it's by jail. It's sort of up to the jail to decide, like, hey, this is how we're going to handle these, and this is the level of care, and maybe we're going to have a nurse or we're going to have a doctor on call. one of the other problems that we discovered in our reporting is, you know, there are a lot of private companies that come in and do this healthcare, and they say, oh, you know, we will offer you this package, county, that's cheaper than you doing it, but the care is super substandard.
And then they become an official legal third party, which has its own legal quagmire, because as a third party, they're removed from certain liabilities, and the county is also removed from certain liabilities from what their third-party services do.
Correct. And, you know, it's terrible because what we've seen with these companies over the last several decades is, you know, they'll get into trouble, they'll get sued, that company will just go bankrupt and then reform as a new company. So there was, you know, at one point there was a company called ConMed that ran most of the healthcare in Oregon and or a lot of the healthcare in Oregon and Washington, and then they sort of got sued a bunch and collapsed and reformed as WellPath, and then sort of took over and continued to operate even though they've had all these problems in the past. And there are many counties that still contract with these companies. I think, you know, a lot of jails are starting to realize, like, we need to find a solution to this. We can't be bringing people in that we can't care for. And so there's been, you know, even though our reporting came out and said, like, hey, look at all these times when a jail failed and they allowed someone to die, a lot of jails said, yes, thank you. Nobody's talking about this problem. Nobody's paying attention to this, and we don't want this to happen in our jails. And
they're kind of stuck because, I mean, who are they going to go to for the medical care? These companies are sitting there saying they're doing. See, that's what frustrates me about my cousin's situation, because as far as I've been able to determine, just before he passed away on the Sunday morning, the Saturday before, he was in the medical ward sitting there saying he was having withdrawal issues and all that.
Mm-hmm.
On the intake, there was no indication of any drugs or alcohol in his, or him being intoxicated or under the influence of anything, and they took him to court. They arrested him on Thursday, took him to court Friday. He ended up back in the booking detox. Saturday, he ended up in the medical ward. They stabilized him, whatever that was to them, actually, and then finally put him back in the jail cell booking detox area, which was filled with like 12 other inmates, and he was found dead the next morning. Like, and I still can't even myself, as a journalist and family, can't even get the entire information from the medical examiners, from the Clark County Jail, from anybody.
Yeah, I mean, the jails will often claim a lot of exemptions. You know, they'll say there's privacy issues, or, you know, we don't, this is part of a process and we don't report that, or, you know, that was a big roadblock that we hit in our own reporting. And it, like I said, it took us 8 months to be able to even just get the most basic information for the folks who are dying in jails. You know, one good thing that came out of our reporting was after this came out, the legislature said, you know, we need to start tracking this. We need to start at least understanding this problem. And so they passed a bill that they will now start requiring jails to track this, because up until this year, they hadn't. I mean, it's a complete black hole of, like, only the jail knows who's dying in there and why they're dying.
Yeah. And those family members who can't really even speak out much.
Right, right. So. Yeah, I mean, really the only recourse for family is legal action against the jail.
Which is where groups like the ACLU would come in extreme circumstances, but they can't be there for the majority of instances.
Right, right, right. Yeah, so, I mean, we're talking about 300 people who have died, and, you know, families are devastated, and, you know, they oftentimes just want to put this behind them, and they don't want to go through the, like, lengthy process of a court case. It's very trying.
I think it also destroys faith in the system that they have.
Yeah.
And see, that's kind of where my aunt, my cousin's mom, was landing, too. She kind of handled everything trying to just let it all go, but I myself, digging and reaching out to a few different sources, I know I was able to get testimonial from inmates that were there when my cousin was dealing with the issues on the Sunday morning before he was dead, trying to get guards and attention for over an hour or two and not being able to do so. Because I got that testimonial, she's been pushing it further and is like, okay, this is going to happen. This is.
Well, it's important. I mean, I think that's really important work to do because, you know, by pursuing those cases and by bringing these cases to light, it attempts to hold someone accountable for this, because at the end of the day, what a lot of people don't think about is, like, who is in jail. It's almost entirely people who could use other services or who are not convicted of any crime, right? Like, anybody could end up in jail on any night. You go out and have too many drinks, and maybe you get in a fight, and then you end up in jail.
In the drunk tank for either a violent charge or just being drunk.
Right. And what we saw in our reporting was, you know, there's some pretty egregious deaths. There was a case in Washington where a young man, I think he was in his 20s, had gone into a jail, and he told them, I have a dairy allergy. And the next morning, someone gave him oatmeal with dairy in it, and he died.
Oh, my goodness.
And, you know, there was a case in Jefferson County, Oregon, Central Oregon, where a man had a bleeding ulcer, and nobody took him serious, and he was vomiting blood, and you know, the jailers thought he was detoxing off some substance, and he ended up dying. There are cases where there is negligence, where people in these jails who are running these jails are not taking health concerns seriously.
It just seems ridiculous to me with the kind of technology we have as well. I mean, just thinking about what these cases that you're saying, how they've happened, I'm just imagining how they could easily have done this differently just to mark this fellow's allergy. If, you know, they put everybody in the computer when you come in, they take your photo, so you've got a record. Why don't they slap one of those little bracelets around your wrist that you can cut off when you're released, like you get at the hospital? Someone with a little barcode on it that's got your file number. And so whenever they've got a deal with you, they can scan you in and see that you've got an allergy or an ulcer, that you need certain treatment.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of substandard care in jails. And I think that we're sort of in this moment where people are reconsidering the criminal justice system and how we think about it and what they want to pay for. And I think a lot of these jails are very old. You know, they're built in the 80s and 90s or even the 70s, you know, in this sort of tough on crime era when there was this big expansion of how many people were going to jail. And, you know, the United States wanted to deal with crime by just putting more people in jails. And so now we have these facilities and these technologies in these jails that are just grossly outdated. And nobody, but the thing is if you go to the community now and you say, hey, we want to build a new jail, people will be like, I think we have a problem with mass incarceration. Maybe we don't want to pay for a jail, or, you know, I don't want to spend my tax dollars on that. And so there's not an appetite to build new jails and bring them up to date. But at the same time, we're still sending way too many people to jail. You know, that was another issue we found in our reporting, is a lot of these jails are so overcrowded. You know, buildings that are built for 150 people are holding 450, 500 people. You know, you're sleeping 3-4 to a cell.
And one aspect of that also is it's so overcrowded that a lot of people are not really realizing that a lot of these low-level offenders are getting arrested, put in jail, and then getting matrixed out.
Right.
And that's because there's no room for them.
Right.
I mean, I myself have been kind of looking at this whole situation developing in the jails also along the lines of the whole last year's report of 52% of police calls were about unwanted individuals. And how the whole homeless population and mentally ill, the drug-addled, are being overly policed and thrown up into the jail system, and it's overcrowding it all.
Right, right, yeah, and it's you know, it's not a good place to be. Also, if you have, you know, if you have mental health issues, being in jail is the worst place for you to be. It just exacerbates those problems significantly, and then people get released, and then their problems are worse, and then they get arrested again, and they go back into jail, and those problems get worse. And it's sort of this self-repeating cycle that, you know, if we're going to reconsider criminal justice, then we need to fund mental health, we need to fund substance.
And one public information request I actually put in, it was actually by my friend Mike Bibbins' request, was, he was like, yeah, you need to reach out to Multnomah County Jail and actually ask them, how many inmates they're releasing that they classified as being homeless or mm-hmm. houseless, mm-hmm. and what percentage they were releasing from their inmates that are just going straight onto the streets. And yeah. when I did so, they came back at me and they're like, oh, we don't track that. And it's like,
you might track that.
You don't track that?
Yeah. Yeah, because most people, when they enter, I think you have to give an address, so they should know. Yeah.
Exactly. And then how many of the transient individuals that are coming in there that aren't able to give them an address mm-hmm. are being released back mm-hmm. out onto the street, yeah. and they're not tracking that.
Yeah,
they're not tracking people coming in that are not giving them address. Are they not tracking people coming out with no address? It's just the system's flawed in so many aspects.
Yeah.
See, another point of discourse when discussing the criminal justice system is that it's there's increasing privatization of a lot of portions mm-hmm. of it, not just when you're saying the medical, mm-hmm. but just actual security officers, maybe the people that are manning the gates kind of security. And they're not all fully county employees anymore, and there's big money to be made in private services. Mm-hmm.
Or the jails might even be working with multiple companies, and those companies aren't talking amongst each other.
Mm-hmm.
The medical, the food systems, the guards, everything else. Everybody might be their own different company and not talking right. amongst each other. They don't know what's really going on.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean,
because then you have privacy issues with third-party companies, mm-hmm. and that becomes its own issue. That could be quite possible.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, definitely. You know, I think counties are often cash strapped, and jails are very, very low on their priority for where they want to spend money. So if they can get a private contractor who offers a low bid, and you know, maybe they would take those services.
I mean, I myself have been interested in a while for like the geographical positions of the jails and the prisons in both the cities and the states, to see where, you know, are most of the jails clustered in the city, are most of the prisons clustered in the rural, to get them out of the city.
What's the income, median income range in the areas mm-hmm. where these jails are? Mm-hmm. And that often plays a factor, because people that have the money to go and stand up to City Hall and take a day off work
right.
and afford that time
right.
to go and say, no, please don't put that in my backyard. But yeah. people working two or three jobs in a low-income area don't have that ability as easily.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think all of this just helps create a greater distrust between the public and government and police, all of those officials.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I have a childhood memory of going through Southern Oregon and going through and seeing Happy Valley Maximum Security Prison. And I was like, excuse me?
I lived for about a mile and a half away from Folsom Prison, you know. Like,
oh, did you?
Folsom Prison, yeah, like Folsom Prison.
Famous.
Famous prison, right. And it was a very well-to-do neighborhood, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And we're mainly talking about the jail system right now for the
right.
medical, but I mean, it's also in the prisons as well, correct?
Yeah, for sure. It's, you know, actually, it's funny. Just this week, we did a look. We published looking at deaths in prisons versus jails. And there's definitely a lot of people that die in prisons, but it's very different in terms of what people die from in prison.
Mm-hmm.
Jail is very much a traumatic situation where someone's coming in at like the worst day of their life, basically, right? And maybe they have drug use problems, or they have a health problem, or whatever. And what we found when we did our jails reporting was like most people who die in jails die within 3 days of entering jail. Because
oh, wow.
it's such a traumatic situation. I mean, like, vast majority, like 70% die within, like,
yeah, the,
if they die, they
die. Where
my
cousin falls into.
Right.
Makes me wonder if that has something to do with the way that we can process intense levels of stress.
It's a very good question of, like, hey, if we know, because the thing is before we did our reporting, nobody was, like, looking at this and looking at this data. But now we know in those first week or whatever, that is like a very critical period when we need to watch somebody. We need to make sure they're safe. We need to get them the help that they need.
And make sure they're stabilized.
And if we get them through that, you know, they'll sort of, in most cases, be okay.
Yeah.
What we saw when we looked at prisons, because prisons are cases where, you know, someone's been convicted of a crime. They're going to be there for a long time. It's a much more stable situation. So you tend to see more
homicide, suicide.
You do see more homicide. You see fewer suicides, actually, because it's it's just sort of their life at that point. Huh. You see health problems, you know, it's an older population a lot
so,
of times.
Yeah, you see natural health issues develop and whatnot.
Right,
yeah.
So it's definitely very different. I mean, it's still got a lot of the same overcrowding, lack of, like, quality services problems, but it's not the same type of, like, intensity that you see in jails where it's, like,
there's like in The Shawshank Redemption.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Good movie.
It is a great movie.
So, now that I got you in here, totally. I can finally jump from subject to subject. I'm so happy. Another one I want to cover is the protests downtown. Mm-hmm. And I myself am known for being a videographer, photographer for the protests and getting up and close and personal. I know OPB does some reporting on it. How do you guys report on it, really?
You know, we try to choose which protests we cover because there's many of them and you know, sometimes they're small and, well, you know, oftentimes they're small. I think, you know, you've probably seen there's probably a handful over the past, like, 3 or 4 years that have been really big events that sort of rise to that higher level.
And most of them happen in August, apparently.
Yes. Yeah. Summer is a good time for people to be outside street fighting, I guess. You know, I think we try to balance covering it and getting people the news they need without hyping it up and making it seem like the whole city's burning, you know, because I think that's the impression that people who don't live here have is, like, Portland's so dangerous. There's just Antifa running around and there's Proud Boys and people are getting their heads split and they're getting milkshaked. And it's, I mean, you guys know, it's just not the truth. Like, you go to these things often, it's like a block or two and maybe there's some intensity, but, you know,
the intensity happens in spots. The intensity isn't, like, everywhere across the city.
Right.
It's in this small, less than usually a quarter mile area.
Yes.
Overall.
And it's a huge, you know, there's a huge misinformation campaign that happens around every one of these things. Every time I go to one, the next, like, 4 days I spend on Twitter trying to debunk all these lies that come in. And it sort of feels useless, but I also feel an obligation to be like, no, I was there. This is what happened. Like, I saw it myself.
That's kind of more or less what me, and I'm not sure how much Leslie did here on social media about the whole cement milkshakes. Mm-hmm. I literally voiced my, I was there.
Yeah, it was BS.
I looked at
I think
the,
we all know it was BS
it
at this point.
It was complete BS.
How did that little song we made up go?
I can't even
remember. How did it go? My milkshakes, cement milkshakes bring Proud Boys to the yard. And they said, your cement is hot. And they said, something silly like that around that time it came out.
Yeah,
we couldn't believe how big that got, honestly. Yeah.
We were mocking it because, I mean, it was just so silly. Mm-hmm. I mean,
there's still people that believe that. That's the problem, right?
Like, right, that you can't quite correct everybody's misinformation, unfortunately. They're going to believe what they want to believe.
There's a lot of people that
want to
believe. Right.
And for myself, when I'm sitting there watching the front line of the Antifa sitting there getting, like, talked to over the bullhorn by officers and then saying boo as they're drinking their milkshakes and then throwing the milkshakes they're drinking at the officers, and that's supposedly when the cement milkshake was thrown, I'm like, they were drinking cement?
Yeah.
From my understanding from some of what was released afterward, an officer said that he had received
that tip.
It was
one officer.
And he was trying to be fair and say, hey, at least I got this tip. I want to make sure someone knows about it. That seems reasonable. But I think it's interesting that out of all the officers there, they took only the word of a single officer that was not corroborated by anyone else, and they let it be de facto. I think that is the element that's really
I think where Portland police really messed up was putting that information out there without confirming it. You know, I think during these events, people look to Portland police official media channels as like, hey, what is actually happening? Because there is so much misinformation. So when Portland police go on their Twitter account and say there's cement milkshakes being thrown, of course, people are like, oh, they're, you know, you're official, you're police. You're only going to say the facts. So I think everybody who goes to these, including the police, needs to be highly responsible about what they actually saw, what they actually know is happening. And it's something that, you know, mistakes happen for sure. And I don't think anybody should be afraid to say I'm wrong, you know, including the Portland police. They could have come out the next day and said, hey, this was one report, turns out, wasn't right. Sorry, our bad. And I think everybody would have been like, thank you for correcting the record.
I would have appreciated that at least.
Right. Right. I mean, a press release saying no cement in the milkshakes was ever discovered.
Instead, we've got the local publications running stories about it for another, 2 weeks afterwards, nearly.
And then, like, Willamette Week, I think it was, did, like, an examination of what would happen when getting hit by a cement milkshake.
Right, although they actually went and bought some quick mix cement and put on stuff.
We both had a laugh. Me and Leslie were laughing at that one. Like, really? They actually made an article of what it looks like for a cement milkshake and what it looks like to get hit with one. And it's like,
It doesn't splash.
See, it's this kind of drama that is what led the Clackamas County Sheriff, Craig Roberts, to not want to support the Portland police in a lot of events. And that was something you wrote about in April.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think there's a lot of controversy around how Portland police is. And there's, you know, I think a lot of these neighboring jurisdictions, when they come in, they don't want to get sued. You know, I think that. I mean, when Craig Roberts said that, he sort of framed it as like, you know, Portland's this lawless place. We don't want to be involved with that. But, you know, I think a lot of it came down to there was a Washington County sheriff's deputy who got sued as part of an assist on a law enforcement case. And I think other agencies were like, look, we don't want to get sued. If Portland's not going to take a responsibility for these when we come in and help them, we're just not going to help them. And I think, you know, it's dangerous. In a situation like these protests, it takes a lot of officers. And, you know, the August 17th protest, we saw tons of officers out. And it actually made a difference. It stopped that from being violent.
Yeah, but you also couldn't cross the street. I was there on August 17th. And I was just literally walking by myself, no chanting, no slogans. Yep. I've got a press badge on, and they just wouldn't let me cross the street. Yeah. At one point, an officer flat out lied to us, told us we weren't allowed until we showed our badges.
And then he said,
no, you can actually just go around here and go around the block. Go that way.
I was sitting there holding my badge in front of his face, and I was like, are you going to assault a journalist right now? And he's like, no, you can just go around the block.
No, you had better luck than me. There was a couple spots I couldn't get around at all.
It wasn't easy, but it was an interesting moment to experience down there.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think anybody wants to see, like, a big, huge police state on their streets, right? I also don't want to see someone get killed. And I think that protest in particular, there was a lot of lead up. There were a lot of people coming from way out of state, coming here just to get in fights. And
they came in on the buses.
Yes. I mean, there were Nazis who came here. The American Vanguard, they're a Nazi organization, or they were founded by a neo-Nazi who pretends to be a quote-unquote constitutionalist. I think these groups have gotten smart about hiding what their true intentions are. But
double
that doesn't
speak. They're very good with the double speak and twisting a narrative that supports their motives.
Right. And so they come here, and I would love to see police stop them from coming to our city, but, you know, there's also free speech, and it's a tricky...
And they, you know, if they're going to get better cooperation from that group, then why wouldn't they?
Right.
You know, communicate with them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's another issue at play that a lot of outsiders don't understand is that these neo-Nazis are playing nice-nice with the police officers, which is a huge controversy in the city. But at least they're trying to be communicative, whereas the people on the other side, labeled Antifa, are not being communicative at all. Like, there's no level. It's at zero. And they're wondering why they're being shut out in the cold.
Yeah. I mean, it's really interesting. One of my reporters has been working on a story, and he was talking to Portland police about this, and they even admitted, like, look, we know that these guys are, like, trying to be nice to us, so we're nice to them. And we have to understand that just because someone calls, you know, shouts at us, it doesn't mean that they're our enemy or we should enforce the law differently. So I think Portland police are, like, have taken the very, very long road of learning the lessons that they should have learned a couple years ago about how to deal with these things.
And unfortunately, it took them getting burnt to do
And it took the neighboring counties to remove some of their assistance.
Right.
For
right.
Them to
so
realize.
It's entirely on Portland now. You have to figure this out, right?
Right. Exactly.
Mm-hmm. And the one I've been wondering about was the National Guard and Governor Kate Brown. Mm. If that wasn't also somewhat connected to that aspect of
that was interesting, right? Like, you know, for people who don't know the story, before the August 17th protest, the city had requested the governor release some National Guard troops to be on some type of backup, maybe to assist if things got crazy. And the governor said no, but didn't actually tell the city. They told the FBI, and the city just happened to find out because the FBI had emailed the city and let
them
know.
Wasn't the city of Portland part of a joint terrorism task force, at FBI group?
They were. They were at one
point. And that's
the
same group that has been watching environmental protesters down in Coos Bay and organizing with them down in that county.
Yeah, Portland pulled out after Joanne Hardesty got on the council. Portland pulled out of the joint terrorism task force. But, you know, for many years they were on there. But yes, the FBI, their definition of who is a terrorist is certainly suspect. That was something that, you know, we reported on a lot in Bundyville. And, you know, I think in historically what you've seen is the FBI and federal law enforcement not understanding right-wing terror and extremism and instead focusing either on international terror or during the 90s and even to today focusing on quote-unquote eco-terrorists, you know, if they, you know,
if you block pipelines, if you've supported the No Keystone, No Dapple, or any of like the Jordan Cove pipeline, the LNG, all of that here on the West Coast, if you're against the tar sands being sent through, a lot of those, as well as Black Lives Matters, actually on that same list.
Mm-hmm. Yes, correct. The FBI, I believe it was The Intercept who originally reported that. You know, the FBI had been tracking Black Lives Matter and other groups as quote-unquote black extremists, which is outrageous,
very,
sort of.
It's very outdated to me. When I read that, I was thinking, wow, what century are we living in for me to read this right now?
Well, you have to think of who's in the FBI, right? Like, it's mostly white people, mostly older folks who sort of have a particular bias towards who they see as terrorists and who they see as extremists in this country. And they don't often see folks who, you know, live in rural communities or, you know, are just involved in white power movements as being extremists. But they, you know, they're far more dangerous. You know, when you start looking at the stats,
a lot of school shootings and violent public outing shootings, a lot of these gun issues where we've had mass deaths have been tied back to individuals that turn out to be white, cis males of a certain socioeconomic range, of certain ideologies. They're very on the constitutionalist, neo-Nazi side of the spectrum. And they fit that bill. It's and it's not actually being, I think, discussed at the levels of government that it should be. And instead, we're worried about people that are trying to prevent oil spills. Right?
So. And see, this, I myself in my mass communications society class this term have been kind of doing some like research into the Spotlight investigation out of Boston about the whole Catholic Church situation there. And I kind of look at this whole thing as kind of like, you know, is it all really just so systemically ingrained, not only the ideologies about the terrorism within these different governmental organizations, but the whole way that these people are behaving in the Catholic Church? Is it all just ingrained into the next generation of people they're training? And is it just being passed on?
So you mentioned something a minute ago that our listeners may not be aware of. Bundyville.
Oh, yes.
Will you tell the listeners a little bit about the Bundyville? It's a podcast. Correct.
Yes, it's a podcast and a written series. So, some folks may remember in 2016 there was this group that came to Oregon and took over a wildlife refuge. The Malheur National Wildlife Refuge in Harney County, Oregon. And that group was led by Ammon Bundy and his brother Ryan Bundy. And they are a couple guys who grew up in Nevada on the ranch of Cliven Bundy, who's their father, obviously. And he is the person who led the 2014 armed standoff against federal agents down there near his property. It goes back to, Cliven Bundy grazing his cattle on public land, and he doesn't think the federal government owns land. And so... Anyway, flash forward, because there's so much history there. I don't want to get too far into it. But anyway, so after the trials of the Bundys, they were acquitted in Oregon, and they had a mistrial in Nevada, so they were never held accountable for any of their actions. Myself and another journalist who's based here in Portland, Leah Satilli, she's a freelance journalist, decided to pursue a podcast, and she did a written series on longreads.com if anyone wants to read it. It's there. Looking at sort of the history of the Bundy family, how they rallied this group of extremists together. That was sort of season one of the show. And then season two, which just came out this year in July, focuses on a lot of the people around them and the ties to white supremacy that they have and Christian extremism and sort of this broader right-wing movement that's kind of having this cultural moment right now where they feel empowered to pursue their agenda.
Yeah, I kind of binge-watched myself the entire thing. And then I remember at the live event you were saying that you guys hadn't really profiled any of the Patriot Prayer or those groups.
Right, right.
And I think one of the questions that came up, and it's one that I figured I'd post to you right now, was like, why didn't you guys profile those groups?
It's a good question. And it's something we talked about. You know, when we were doing the second season, we said, you know, there's obvious ties there, right? Like, there's obvious, like, sort of... the ideology that they have is like this sort of like take America back to whatever perfect utopia they envision. But at the end of the day, we felt like, you know, Patriot Prayer is, it feels like a big group for us here in Portland because we're here and we see it.
Yeah.
But it, you know, for the wider world, it's not. And we worried that us reporting on them help their profile, right?
Yeah, like, spread their message.
Right.
And,
right. And so we ended up focusing a lot on groups that have actually committed acts of violence across the West.
Yeah.
And sort of that was kind of the angle we took. Obviously, Patriot Prayer and their members have committed violence. They've engaged in physical assaults of people.
But yeah, you don't really hear about Patriot Prayer much past the West Coast, in my opinion.
Right, right.
Occasionally, you hear about them popping up in New York or somewhere like that, but it's usually a small group of them because they paid their own way to get there. It's not like they're supported. But, you know, and then... more nationally, you'd hear about the Proud Boys, but those guys were disbanded, like, I don't know, over a year ago, supposedly?
Yeah, well, sort of.
Sort of. They're still, like, hanging out together, but I guess officially, and Gavin McGinnis or whoever it was that started them was, like, long gone from the group.
It's a big problem when you report on this type of stuff. It's a question we all have to ask ourselves of, like, what is shining a light and what is giving a platform?
Yeah.
And I think... you know, I do think it's important to report on Patriot Prayer. I don't think that they shouldn't be reported on. But I also felt like I don't want to make them seem more powerful than they are.
Don't give them too much focus, basically.
Right.
You don't want to go in every rally and give every single one of those guys a platform to sit there and speak 5 minutes on video or an article and be, oh, this is what I believe in, this is why you should believe in it, and yada, yada, yada. But honestly, profiling what's going on at the rallies and stuff, that's more or less what I try to do.
Yeah, totally.
Is report on exactly physically what happened.
Yeah, and, you know, I think that, like I said, that's important because I think it's important for the truth to get out there about what happens at these rallies, you know, and people are often looking to spin a story out of them, and I think you can just report truthfully what happens and people can see for themselves of what is really going on at those rallies.
So that just made me think of the book that we were talking about
before the podcast,
Permanent Record. Yes. I read that, got that for my birthday.
I actually
amazing.
Got her to watch episodes of Joe Rogan
because of Snowden on there. Oh, it's the first one I watched it probably all the way through. I had no idea how long it was sitting there. All I know is that I get a phone call interrupting me for the first time. I noticed how long I was watching the episode. And it was over an hour into it, and it was him calling me. And I was a little grumpy. I was like, what are you doing? I got to go. I'm busy. And I hung up on him after he told me what he wanted. And to get back into it, and I realized, wow, this is 2.5 hours, yeah. And I'm already halfway through very this, long. And it's not long enough.
Yeah, the moment I saw Ed Snowden on Joe Rogan, and I'd been talking to her because this podcast itself is kind of based off of how Joe mm-hmm. does long-form interviews mm-hmm. and trying to bring people in and giving more more candid mm-hmm. responses, more live-action interviews. And so I was like, oh, Leslie, you need to check out Joe Rogan. She's like, eh, I've heard.
I see some clips here. There's stuff. He's got some amazing guests, but I'm not a religious watcher like
it's
my podcast co-host here.
I listen to just about any podcast. I read any article. I don't care about the where the content is coming from. I try and ingest it and actually try and rationalize through
that's
it all.
That's good.
I mean, I can sit there and put up with Fox News for a few hours and sit there and get the content that's actually needed.
You're still getting some points, and you can still go and look up other things about it.
Right.
Or I can go the extreme other angle and go, like, watch Vice or something mm-hmm. like that and mm-hmm. do the exact same. I try and pull as much information out of this as possible. It's just the best way to go about it.
His book was extremely informative. I'm going to have to loan it to you if you are really gentle with it. But
see,
I might loan it to you.
He's reading Edward Snowden books. I'm reading Hunter S. Thompson books.
I've got a few books I'm reading right now.
I've read both.
I'm reading right now also one called Techno Creep. And it was written in like 2014.
Uh-huh.
It's really good. And the author is talking about some of the things that I feel like are alluded to by Snowden, like some of the same programs and the capabilities for them to sort of talk about stuff. And
it's hard. I can only read so many of those books at a time because it just freaks me out. I'm like, I got to turn my phone off and hide it in the bathtub.
Well, is your bathtub made of metal? You need a Faraday cage for that.
Yeah, but, you know, Snowden's book was fantastic. I would encourage anybody to read it because I think, you know,
it just narrates his experience, everything that he sort of went through and learned, like
and
how
why
he understand
chose
it, and
to do
he
what
it.
He did, I think is like really important for people to understand. And I think,
and that's the one thing our government is disallowing him from doing, is they refuse to allow him to use that defense and explain why he did it,
which
to me is a huge issue when it comes to the justice system, because you're supposed to be innocent until proven guilty. And you shouldn't be forcing someone into a position that's going to make them only look guilty because you won't allow them to have any other actions. There's no choice allowed. There's no freedom in
that. Right, right. And, you know, what's really sad to me is, like, I think we're sort of, you know, we're a number of years removed from the whole NSA whistleblower thing when it was fresh. And people have kind of forgotten, you know. They kind of have let this technology creep into their lives, and they have Alexa listening to them at home. And
how about the drone surveillance? Yeah. There are times I speak to my podcast host and I ask him, hey, don't you ever see the drones flying above the city of Portland? And he tells me no.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's just because I'm out and about just doing stuff all the time. But I see them a lot, and especially at night, because at night they can hide more. And they have all the technology.
And then about 2-3 months ago, I came across an article. I'm not sure who it was from, but it was basically talking about how the city of Portland has been using drones flying over the city to keep track of racing and whatnot. And I'm like, oh, I guess there are drones flying over Portland.
Right. It's actually been happening increasing just in my personal experience, just watching it over the last about 3 to 4 years since I've really been out and about and active in the city.
It's hard not to see it.
Really paying attention to it. Yeah, it's hard not to notice it. And there are literally times that drones will follow, like, right above me. And I have to wonder, like, why are we driving the same direction
right
now?
Well, it's hard.
I mean,
it's hard. It's like, how much is, like, law enforcement? How much is just people with drones? You know, because they're so accessible now, people can just buy them. And I
think you have to have a permit to fly them in the city. And actually, it is illegal. We did speak to a fellow at the August 17th protest who was flying a drone. And he told us it's illegal to fly a drone over a human body.
Yes,
any
that
person
is correct.
Whatsoever.
I actually have a drone license from the FAA.
Okay.
Yes, I got one for journalism, and I could not fly a drone for the life of me. But
I was just not too long ago, because I was talking about that same thing with when I was working with the PSU Vanguard and the Sentinel. I was like, can we get hold of like somebody in the computer programming department and be like, can they set it up so it's like a proximity, so all I have to do is walk and it just follows me? That way it's just recording and I'm just doing my thing,
well,
working the crowd.
I think they do. Actually, some drones do, like, if you have the camera, it'll track you and fly with you. But, yeah. But, yes, actually, yes, you're not allowed to fly over people. There's many places in the city you're not allowed to fly for safety reasons.
You can't go over public buildings, certain kinds of public buildings. You can't go over courthouses.
You can't be over
jails.
A certain height of flying because it's a danger.
And it enters the airway for airplanes.
What I will say is there are many people who own drones who don't know any of these rules and don't follow them, unfortunately. It's very dangerous,
and
actually.
And see, the article I came across was actually saying the drones that the city of Portland were using were actually some of the high-altitude ones that you would see, like, the military using.
Mm, right, yeah. Like, people wouldn't have those, yeah.
Yeah, and that's the kind she's mostly been
seeing,
too.
Well, that's what made
me like,
think
like,
about it at first was, I mean, all of these leaks, you know, in the past half decade or more, there's that Reuters journalist that was killed with the drone, right?
So. Yeah. I mean, I think people should take surveillance very seriously, and I think they should take their civil rights very seriously. You know, we've sort of forgotten that, you know, right to search and seizure and, you know, your Fourth Amendment rights are being violated constantly by the federal government. And, you know, unless there is public pressure on the government to change these programs and to sort of dial back this surveillance state, it's not going to change, you know.
Unfortunately, the government tends to do things that make people feel more watched.
Yeah.
They spend the money on things that are more oversight-like.
Right.
One of them, the TriMet thing.
Yes, that was another one I wanted to bring up with you was the increased fare inspectors that TriMet just rolled out.
Right, right.
People want more safety. When they've done the studies and the research from the public, says we want more safety on TriMet and MAX trains and buses. And somehow TriMet came back and decided that safety meant fare inspectors. Mm-hmm. And fare inspectors are there purely to make sure you've paid your, what, $2.50 to $5 for your ticket. Mm-hmm. They are not there to make sure you're safe. They are not there to check for weapons. They are not there to make sure that, you know, you're not being slanderous or violent. They have none of that. No training for that as well.
And there's been a lot of argument also online on Twitter and Facebook that have basically been saying that, you know, it's only something like 16% of TriMet's revenues coming from the fares. And that can be cut out.
Right, right.
And to make fares free.
I don't know. I mean, I think if TriMet wanted, they could go to a tax system where it's basically, you know, everyone has a 0.002% tax that they pay every year on their tax bill that would go to make up that sort of 16%. I think they're, I don't know how TriMet arrived at the conclusion of more fare inspectors makes public transport safer. You know, I sort of started to dig back and understand where this was coming from, because I wanted to know, like, why now? Why did they decide to take this action now? And, you know, I started looking back, and, like, last year there was a big, I wouldn't say big. They put up a Facebook post after they had increased fares or something like that. And, you know, some folks on that were like, oh, you know, I would like fare inspectors, but, and here's the catch that they didn't say recently when they announced more fare inspectors. These are folks who are like, I don't like homeless people on public transportation.
Right.
They stink, blah, 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 whatever. Some, you know, talking like they're not people.
Yeah.
And like they shouldn't have access to public transportation.
Very degrading against their humanity.
Totally. And so my sense is like, maybe that is what this is based on, and I don't think most Portlanders want that or agree with that. And I think what we saw in the backlash on Twitter and Facebook to this most recent decision to add more fare inspectors was a lot of people saying, like, BS, I don't want more fare inspectors. I don't care, frankly, whether, you know, I think they said something like, you know, people feel cheated when someone else gets on a bus and didn't pay, and
I think actually that's not true. I see people get up to pay that person's fare.
Right.
I don't see people get angry.
Right.
I see people being helpful.
Yes.
And
anyone who has been on the MAX or on a bus, you know, nobody ever is like, hey, that guy didn't pay.
And sometimes there's like three people buying a ticket. The MAX train is pulling in right then.
Right.
And if you don't get through those doors when they're open, that train will leave.
Right.
And someone else is using the only ticket machine that works.
Right.
And there's no way to purchase a ticket once you're on the train. And that blows my mind.
And with Hop Pass, you don't even know now. Like, someone could just pay on their phone, and you don't know if they paid or not.
I have a pass through my school, and it is not digital. So it does not require me to use the Hop thing. Mm-hmm. And I do not you need to go to the ticket booths.
Right.
So nobody ever knows. I just literally can walk down the street and onto the train, and they do look at me a little bit. But if I'm dressed nice, they're not worried.
Mm-hmm. I mean, over this last fall term, I ended up doing an article. It was called Hop on This and Go for a Spin. And it was basically picking apart the new Hop Pass system. And it was basically talking about how there was the student pass, which is a little sticker that goes on the student ID and it lasts all term. And it was costing like $160 to $180. And so that right there was a pretty much reduced bus fare for college students of like 120 or whatever.
Is it a decent discount that you can afford to get to class and then do your basic.
Right. TriMet also unrolled the low income fare program, which made it $28 a month. Now, when I was reporting on that whole Hop Pass situation, it was because I was talking to a lot of the resource centers in town, and they were saying that TriMet was trying to transfer from the old paper pass to the new Hop Pass, which is laminated paper, and trying to make it so that it was phased out at the end of June. And that all the resource centers were having trouble even getting hold of TriMet to get the new Hop Passes to even be able to provide to the homeless people or the low-income individuals that come in to get those.
There are people that ride just like those unhoused people that don't carry phones, that don't carry electronic devices, as well as people that may have jobs and homes, but don't believe in carrying cell phones or don't engage in that activity. And yet we are now going to require them to get Hop Passes and have electronic passes that they keep on devices.
That was one of the things in my article. I was basically like, they have the low-income fare program and the student program that they're not connecting. Why? I mean, a lot of college students are low-income individuals.
Right.
And then you have these resource centers that are getting screwed out of being able to get the new Hop Passes for the people they're trying to provide them for. And then another one that I was pointing out was, you know, the lack of being able to charge phones if you're homeless, being able to access the app, being able to even get yourself into the program if you even know about it. Are they running programs at service centers? Sitting there, you can't even hop onto a Max, and if you have forgotten to scan, you can't scan it on the Max. You're pretty much entrapped on the Max. So
if you have, like, you're halfway there, and like I said, that train's pulling in the station, it's either get on and risk, you know, being late to work and getting fired and getting caught. Like, those aren't good choices. Those are non-choices.
Correct.
And within about a month of my article coming out, they connected the low-income fare and student program. They sat
there
and they pushed back the rollout from the paper pass into December, which is coming up.
That's good.
And I'm sitting there, I'm like, there's so many little design flaws within so many of these systems, and it just needs to be addressed. And sometimes the only way to do it is journalistically and bring it to the public attention. Even if it doesn't reach the public and they make the outroar, if it reaches the eyes of the people that are key in it.
Well, I think it's important to understand that these decisions affect a lot of different people with a lot of different perspectives and backgrounds. And unless those people are involved in the decision-making process, it's hard to sort of make sure that those decisions account for their place, you know?
One of the last things I wanted to ask you, too. So there is, like, a crisis within the journalism world of, like, lowering of readership and whatnot. This actually comes from my class. It's one of the questions from, my final paper. As newspapers decline nationwide, what can be done to best ensure the production of the high-quality news necessary for our democracy?
Well, I mean, I think there's a lot of answers to that question. I think that it depends on how you look at it and why there is a decline in readership among newspapers and other media outlets. I think first and foremost, it's important for journalists to hold the standard of journalism and not chase the quick and easy thing or the most controversial thing.
The clickbait.
Because it gets views. Because, you know, it may get you views, but people also see through that. People are smart and understand what good journalism is, and they don't want to be fed really poorly done journalism. And I think we as journalists have to hold that standard. And maybe it takes you longer to do a story. Maybe, you know, like our jail story, it takes 8 months to do that story, yeah, to do it right. And that's not going to be a daily turn thing. It's not going to get website clicks every day during those 8 months. In fact, it's getting no website clicks during those 8 months. And so, like, you know, one thing at OPB is, like, we try to hold the standard of good journalism and don't chase audience, right? And, yeah, you know, we've seen a reward in that because people, like I said, people are smart. They understand that. Our newsroom in the past 4 years has grown. We've hired 10 reporters. You know, we haven't fired a bunch of people. I've worked at newspapers. I know what that's like. It's terrible because you could be doing the best job ever, and then one day your boss can come in and say, guess what? You just got laid off.
Bye.
And it's like, well, God, I've been busting my butt every day for however many years at this job, and you're just going to can me?
Yeah.
I think, you know, the flip side of that is, like, it's important for people to support journalism that they like, you know. We live in an age where everything's free on the internet, and which is great because it creates access. But those of us who are capable of supporting should, you know. It's sort of why KBOO's great. It's why OPB is a good model, because we go to the public and we say, hey, like, we do this service. If you can't afford it, cool. We're here for you. We want you to enjoy the service. If you can, please, you know, do what you can. $5 a month, whatever. I'm in pledge drive now. but I think that model is sort of the model of the internet, right? It's like, it's the democracy of, like, support things that you like. And I think that is sort of the future of journalism. I think, you know, we've seen a lot of companies turn to venture capital in Silicon Valley, and we're sort of seeing that fall apart right now, like Deadspin, right? It's these venture capitalists are just out to make money. They don't give a crap about what journalism is or what it means to democracy. And as soon as it stops making them money or it gets sticky like journalism does, they're out the door. You know, you guys are all fired. See you. We're moving on to the next thing. I think, you know, journalism organizations need to think more about the nonprofit model and sort of insulating from big money and thinking about journalism is central to our democracy. It's central to people understanding what's going on.
It's a public good.
It is a public good, and it makes a difference. Just like your story, it sort of got them to rethink their past system. That's a public good. That's what journalism should be doing. It's fixing problems for people's lives, you know? And so I think it's a complicated issue, but we all have a part to play in sort of fixing it.
It's kind of also reminding people that good journalism is more about information than entertainment.
Absolutely.
So if it's not as entertaining, it might actually be really worthwhile because it wasn't just something that you could sit there and laugh at or have a quick
I myself recently have been kind of sitting here and trying to tell people, if you're doing journalism correctly, it's not really the most financially lucrative career.
Yeah, absolutely not. I've been doing this a long time. I wish I was rich. I'm not.
You barely get by if you're doing
it correctly.
Some people,
I mean, it's like any profession, right? Like, some people are going to be big and they're going to be, you know, whoever, and they're going to get a lot of money, and that's fine.
Yeah.
But I think for most of us, it's a passion, and it is a public service. You know, it's a way to do good in the world. And I think it's really fun too. You know, if you like finding stuff out and asking people questions, it's like, who doesn't want to, you know, have the sort of put the old press thing in your hat and go up to City Hall and say, you know, Mayor Ted Wheeler, I have some questions for you.
That just made me think of Newsies. Right. That movie Newsies. Yes. I watched that a lot as a kid.
Well, Ryan, thank you for coming in, man.
Yeah,
it's
thanks
been
for
a
having
pleasure.
Me.
Yeah, and if anything you want to say to the listeners at the last moment, or
just thanks for having me. This is really fun. I enjoyed this. You know, folks out there, if you hear this program, support Corey, support this show, like
The Bundyville podcast.
Yes.
Well, where could people go to catch up on the written or
absolutely
non-written?
If you're into listening, you can go to any podcast service. Just type in Bundyville. We'll be there. We've got 2 seasons, 14 episodes.
Bundyville.
Correct. Absolutely. Nice. I had to check it in my head. If you want to read the written series, go to longreads.com/Bundyville.
Okay. Awesome. Well,
thank you so much. Yeah, this was fantastic.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, this is Corey with Trippy.
And Leslie. Thanks for being here.
KBOO Portland.